Today is Wednesday, June 14th. We're going to work on more skin information and perhaps start the bones. Okay, so I'd like to take you back into the course pack, top of page 55. So we were talking about various things that can change the pigmentation of your skin. And we had left off talking in here on Monday about cyanosis. We know that cyanosis makes the blue appear, the skin appear blue, but of course the blue color is a trick of the eye. It's not an actual blue color, but rather a dark red color of the blood and the melanin in our skin that makes our eye perceive it as blue. So with jaundice, which is our next type of skin pigmentation issue, what color does the skin appear?
Yellow.
Good. Okay. So when we think about jaundice, we think about which organs being the underlying problem?
Liver.
Good. So what is it the liver produces that could produce a yellowish tint to your skin?
Bile.
Good. So if bile backs up into the bloodstream, which is not what it's supposed to do, then the bile has a yellowish-green color that can actually pigment your skin. Normally, bile should be removed in your feces, and it's broken down there to produce a dark brown color. So that's the normal exit pathway for bile. But, you know, the case of it backing up into the bloodstream actually pigments our skin, our eyes, even our gums a yellowish-green color. There is something called physiological jaundice that some babies are born with. And the reason for this is the bile is not being secreted into the feces yet. Rather, it's actually just plugged up into the liver. So after baby has his or her first bowel movement, the bile starts moving, and we tend to see that jaundice problem goes away. Weird thing about jaundice, the sunlight that you can be exposed to actually breaks down that pigmentation in the skin and helps get rid of it. So imagine being sent home with a newborn baby and being told to put your baby in the sunlight. That is a way to fix and get rid of physiological jaundice. Now, of course, hospitals have those sun lamps that they can put the baby under to help break down the bile pigments, but otherwise, sunlight can do the very same thing. So kind of an interesting concept there. Let's see, our next issue there is called bronzing. And with this issue, we tend to see people body-wide have a darkening effect, and maybe it doesn't have anything to do with being exposed to sunlight. This is a disease here called Addison's disease. We'll talk more about this one when we get into Bio-211. But this particular disorder is an adrenal gland disorder. Where are your adrenal glands located?
Kidneys.
Top of kidneys, good. So if they're not working properly, then we tend to see a bronzing effect of the skin. So if you know someone who has, say, darkening of the skin, perhaps freckle formation when they haven't been exposed to sunlight, then we start looking at that and saying, does that match up with some other symptoms? I think this is probably hard to see with the lights on, so let me get the lights dim for you. Most of us normally don't go out and sun our gums. You know, that's certainly a place in the body where you would not expect to see freckling occur. But this lady has a darkening spot coming here onto her gums, and that comes from having Addison's disease. I don't know how many of us check our gums for dark spots, but, you know, this might have been something that went along with her other symptoms. There are cases where the gums really darken overall, and that, of course, is a warning sign because, like I said, we don't necessarily go out and intend to provide sun to that area. Here's some other more dramatic cases. Look at the gums here. They've darkened. Look at the dark spots starting to collect in these areas here. So they'd have to look for things like skin cancer to eliminate that as a possible issue. But, you know, nonetheless, we're not looking at just regular body exposure to sunlight. We're looking at places that maybe wouldn't normally be exposed to sunlight here. We'll go ahead and talk about vitiligo. That one's our next issue. What happens to the melanocytes for a person with vitiligo? They stop working, right. What is the danger of having melanocytes that don't work? Yeah, you have very big problems from being exposed to UV radiation. All of the parts of his skin here that have absolutely no melanin, what is he at a higher risk for?
Burns.
Burns, yeah. What else?
Cancer.
Cancers, yeah. So this guy is actually a newscaster, and they had a special on him, and they showed him applying makeup so that it would blend in with his existing melanin. So, you know, once he got his makeup put on, you'd have no idea that he had this vitiligo issue going on underneath. But it affects all types of skin tones and skin colors. It is a progressive disorder. Once it starts, it tends to spread and become worse. They do say that things like vitamin B12 shots and lowering your stress can reduce the effects of vitiligo, or at least kind of halt the spread of this disease. This is Michael Jackson's disease, by the way. They confirmed after his death that he did, in fact, have vitiligo. And there is a hormone in your brain that you can shut off that will reduce your melanin production in your skin. So that's likely what he did, because you may have noticed his entire skin tone faded upon most likely shutting off that melanocyte-stimulating hormone. So kind of an interesting disease here, unfortunate disease in that it progresses and can lead to things like very bad burns and skin cancers. Let's see, freckles are very common. What is happening with freckles? Yeah, melanin's trapped in one place, right. So how is it that you can have maybe no freckles, and then after sun exposure, the freckles come and never go away? What's happened to the cells in that area to continue producing those freckles?
They're trying to protect that area.
They're trying to protect that area, yeah. So, you know, sometimes people get a lot of sun exposure, the freckles come, maybe more freckles come, and unfortunately, what's happened is the DNA in those cells has been changed, and so those cells are activated or turned on to produce hyperpigmentation. And so we tend to see these freckles pop up, especially when there's sun exposure. And again, this is across all kinds of skin tones and skin colors. You know, sun exposure can induce this freckling effect. Something related to freckles is something called a liver spot. And this can occur when early in life, maybe you had some sun exposure. Maybe you didn't see freckling earlier in life. But I'm sure you've seen the hands of older people that have these dark spots that come about. Those are liver spots that come from sun exposure earlier in life. And unfortunately, you know, like freckles, they're hard to get rid of. There's not a whole lot we can do. Again, it's the cell that's been changed genetically, and it starts producing these pigmentation spots on the skin. So why do you think the hands are a place where you commonly see these liver spots? Yeah, they're usually exposed, right? Okay, so not a lot of coverage on there. Most of us don't wear gloves year-round, so yeah, a good place to get sun exposure.
A lot of my patients, a lot of the women know the women, they have it sometimes here on their hands, but usually parts that were exposed.
Exactly right, yeah. So the thing is, wear sunscreen, right, because those can pop up later in life and make your skin look mottled. Last one here is called albinism, and in this particular situation, we do have an underlying genetic component. Most people have some type of normal skin genes that produce normal skin pigmentation, but with the case of albinism, their genes are programmed to not produce melanin. They have the melanocytes. So the unfortunate thing is the genes tell the melanocytes don't produce any melanin. So again, like with vitiligo, what kind of risk do we expect to see? Sunburns and cancer, yeah. So not only does this reduce skin pigmentation, it also reduces hair pigmentation. And probably the most devastating issue is the loss of eye pigmentation. So the iris of your eye is the colorful portion, and what is it preventing from getting into the back parts of your eye? Sun, yeah. So the iris is a colorful, pigmented portion, and the whole goal here is to let only enough light come in, but not so much that you burn the back of your retina. Well, a case with these people is they have something called retinosa pigmentosa. They are more likely to develop an eye cancer because that iris is not pigmented, and therefore the sunlight just goes right back into the retina and can cause cancer to form there. So, yeah, that's an unfortunate side effect of having albinism. It's not just a higher risk for skin cancer and burns, but you can also burn and have cancer back there in the back part of your eye. All right, so that takes us down to dermis. Do you guys have any questions on all those various skin color issues? There's a lot of them. You know, we pretty much are every color of the rainbow when you talk about everything from blue and red to yellow, brown, black, and everything in between. So kind of interesting that our skin really tells a story about what's going on inside. Did you get the blank up there for cyanosis? I know that was the last thing we did on Monday. Loss of oxygen, you got it. Bruises are blue because of the loss of oxygen. Do y'all want to keep lights off or turn them back on? Off is good? Okay. All right, so we've kind of finished the epidermis. Just to summarize its functions, its job is to protect the underlying dermis. It is an avascular tissue, so it does not have its own direct blood supply. Instead, it receives its nutrients by diffusion from the underlying dermis. What types of cells are present in your epidermis that help protect the underlying dermis?
Keratin
cells, good. What else?
Melanocytes and Langerhans cells.
Good, melanocytes and Langerhans cells. Which of those three eat bacteria?
Langerhans cells.
Yeah, and how about the melanocytes? How do they protect the underlying dermis?
Protect it from
UV rays. UV rays, good, good. So in normal skin, not necessarily palms or soles, how many strata are there in the epidermis?
Usually four,
good. And the topmost strata is called?
Corneum,
good. And the bottommost?
Basal,
good. Good. And if you have thick skin, like your palms or soles, you do see another additional layer called lucidum. Good. So I wanted to show you this picture so you can appreciate that the epidermis is, in fact, the thinnest layer of our skin, and the dermis is the thicker, deeper layer. I think this picture kind of drives home the point. I do want to point out, though, the bottommost layer of your epidermis, this groovy portion right here is where your stratum basal ends, and the dermis down below is going to begin. I know it's hard to see in this picture, but there's two tissue types in the dermis. There's an upper region right underneath your epidermis that we call the papillary layer. And then most of this stuff down here is probably easy to recognize. What type of tissue is found down below?
Dense irregular,
yeah. So nonetheless, the dermis is the deeper, thicker layer of your skin. Okay. So about midway down your page, let's talk about the papillary and the dermal layer of your skin. These are two regions of your dermis. Which one is superficial to the other?
The papillary is superficial to the reticular.
Good. Papillary is superficial to the reticular. And this is a great picture because you get a sense for that papillary layer creates these little finger-like grooves up into the epidermis. So right through here is where stratum basal is located. I did want to point out this is stratum granulosum, okay? But nonetheless, down here is where we find stratum basal. Up underneath it, this grooved area of your dermis, that's the papillary layer, and there's a specific type of tissue found here. Oftentimes, it is loose areolar, and overall, what's the main job of loose areolar? Support, cushioning. Mm-hmm. What else describes loose areolar?
Wraps
organs, good. And you probably learned that it helps to bind
the epidermis
to the dermis, exactly. So in fact, that is where it's located. It is here between the bottom side of your epidermis and the lower portions of your dermis. So it is a great binding, packaging, connecting material, which is the case with all of our connective tissues. They do some type of job like that. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's any significance to why we have these dermal papillae sticking up into the epidermal areas? Yes, you're right. Fingerprints, good. So you may notice on your skin you've got fingerprints like this, footprints, of course, on your toes and feet. And it's all about grip. You're exactly right. Good. So these areas, even though they have an additional layer of stratum lucidum, actually have just thin enough epidermises to be able to see that grooving effect of the dermal papillae. So we do have no hair on our hands and feet, and that allows for an increased grip. So combine that with these fingerprints and footprints, and you know, we can do more with those body parts than we can with other areas. So I do want to mention that these dermal papillae are found all over your entire body. It's just that you can see them when they have a thin enough layer on the hands and the feet. So one of the underlying reasons for having this pegging effect is to help keep your dermis and your epidermis locked together. You know, if you think about an egg crate appearance, the egg crate has grooves, hills, and valleys, and so if we lock those two layers together, they are less likely to friction off from each other. And that's the goal. We do not want your epidermis slipping and sliding away from the underlying dermis. Can you tell that the papillary layer in this picture is loose areolar? Maybe.
A little bit.
Can you tell that it's different from what starts around right through here?
Yes.
Yeah. It just looks a little different, doesn't it? So let's turn our attention to the deeper reticular layer. That's the one that's down below. You know, it messes with my brain when they call it reticular, because my brain goes to reticular.
Like loose reticular.
And I'm thinking, oh, there must be reticular fibers, and there's not, right? What kind of fiber is in dense, irregular connective tissue?
Collagen,
yes. So don't let the reticular name play with your mind. There is collagen down there in that dense, irregular portion. Dense, irregular is nothing but bundles of collagen fibers that run in all sorts of random directions. So we know about dense tissues. We know that they don't like to heal very well. In fact, if you tear or pull on that dense, irregular connective tissue, we leave behind problems like stretch marks. So, you know, this is an area that is vascular. It does have blood vessels, but nonetheless, it doesn't like to be torn or stretched. That's not really the job of this deeper portion. The job still is to connect your epidermis, dermis, down to the underlying tissues, whatever they may be. I did want to show you some pictures of stretch marks since we're talking about it. I'm sure you guys have seen stretch marks before. When we grow really fast, we can get stretch marks or striae. When we are pregnant as females, we can get stretch marks. If you gain weight really quickly, you can get stretch marks. And despite what all the products on the market say, you don't actually get rid of the stretch mark. You only make them fade in appearance. So what may start out as a very shiny streak through the skin may simply be faded through time. But yeah, once you tear that dermis, especially the dense irregular connective tissue, what do you know about its heal rate? Very slow, very poor, yeah. So, you know, if you're pregnant and you put on 50 pounds during the pregnancy, you know, your body can't possibly keep up with that growth rate during, say, 9 months of pregnancy. So unfortunately, you know, these things are here to stay. Even if they fade over time, there is still a tear in that underlying dermis. Other issues that affect the skin, especially down there between the epidermis and the dermis, are blisters. Boy, this had to be a painful experience. These are henna tattoo blisters. Apparently this person was allergic to the henna tattoo. And when blisters occur, they actually occur at the junction between the dermis and the epidermis. So this region right through here is where the blister would accumulate. We have all been told, don't pop the blister. Why not? Infection, right. So the epidermis is avascular, but the dermis is vascular. So if you pop a blister that's sitting between those two layers, what are you looking at? Where does the bacteria go? Down here into the blood vessels, right? Okay, so that's the unfortunate thing about blisters. If you happen to pop it, or you know, if it pops itself.
You said blisters occur where?
Between the junction of the epidermis and the dermis. Okay, and of course that infection can then travel down into the blood supply that's sitting here in the dermis. And the very last thing on the bottom of this page I wanted to show you is called a line of cleavage. Not the kind of cleavage you might be thinking of, This is a different kind of line of cleavage. These are actually in the dermis of our skin, and they follow the grooves or the lines where the collagen fibers lay. So you'll notice around the body these invisible lines. You can't actually see them by looking at somebody, but we know from dissections that these grooves or lines are actually found in the dermis for those collagen fibers. So you may say, okay, why is this important? Let's talk about surgery for just a moment. C-sections are quite a common thing nowadays. What part of the body is cut for a C-section?
The abdomen.
Abdomen, good. How do they create a cut down here?
Transverse cut.
Transverse cut, okay. So transverse cut runs across, right? So if you make a cut across, what did you just do to the lines of cleavage?
Break them.
So when you're sewed back together and that skin tries to heal, instead of having lines of cleavage that meet up perfectly, you've now got lines of cleavage that are not meeting up perfectly. So what does this do to your chance of rehealing that skin as it was before?
Slows it down.
Slows it down, good. Do you have the same strength if you don't put those collagen fibers back together?
No.
Yeah, that's another issue. So, you know, the ideal C-section would be one that followed the lines of cleavage, which I don't know, V-shape doesn't sound like a very good plan either, does it? But if surgeons follow the lines of cleavage, then we have a better chance of getting that skin, that dermis, to heal properly. Because what we want is those collagen fibers to grow back together like they're made in the skin, like you can see here. So you can see why a cut that goes against the lines of cleavage can be very hard for the skin to heal. So no wonder some surgeries heal really quickly when they follow the line of cleavage versus are really bad or slow to heal when they go against those lines of cleavage. All right, so how about questions so far on page 55? On the top of page 56, let's talk about the hypodermis. Use the prefix. What does hypo tell us?
It's below the dermis.
It's below the dermis. Good. And is this technically a part of the skin?
No.
No. Okay, so when we talk about the layers of the skin, how many are there? There's two. Good. And they are?
Epidermis.
Good. Epidermis and dermis. So, you know, hypodermis is something we do talk about here, but it is not part of the skin. What type of tissue is commonly found here?
Loose
adipose. Loose adipose, good. Anything else?
Loose areolar.
Loose areolar, good. Let's take each one of those. What is loose adipose? What is its function here?
Store energy,
protection, insulation. Anything else? That's pretty much it, right? Okay, so there are adipocytes here, and those adipocytes store energy. The triglycerides in your body are going to be stored here inside these adipocytes. And like we talked earlier, they can swell as big as need be to put as much fat into that area. So that means when we gain weight or lose weight, we're doing so from the hypodermis region. That's where most of our weight gain or weight loss comes from. So in terms of protection and insulation, we are protecting underlying tissues because fat is in fact cushioning, and it also provides a warmth or a barrier for heat loss. So there's some good to having some fat, and of course we know the more you have, the more it will store in that subcutaneous region. I did want to mention that the word hypodermis may alternately be called the subcutaneous layer of fat. And when people have liposuction performed, it is the subcutaneous hypodermis layer that is sucked out. So is this particular tissue vascular or avascular?
Vascular.
Vascular, good. What are the risks of having liposuction on a very vascular tissue? Lots of bleeding, yeah. So, of course, we want to be cautious if somebody is having that hypodermis region manipulated. Hypodermic needles go into this region as well. You know, so if you have a shot that goes into the hypodermic region, we're hoping to put it into this fatty area. Why do you think this is a good place to put a shot of medication?
Straight to the bloodstream,
yeah. So why do you think the dermis up above is a less ideal place to put that shot. Won't go to the bloodstream as fast, right? What is it about the nature of the dermis that prevents movement of stuff fairly quickly? It's dense, yeah. So that loose adipose allows stuff to travel a lot more quickly. So you've got it down pat there. Just wanted to show you this picture so you can see more loose adipose tissue down below. Lots of it sitting right beneath the dermis of the skin. We also have loose areolar here in the hypodermis. What is its function?
Soft support.
Good. So it's anchoring your dermis to underlying muscle, bone, cartilage, whatever else is down below. So it's a great anchoring, binding support device. Good. All right. So not a whole lot there on the hypodermis or subcutaneous layer. That's pretty much it for page 56. Do y'all have any questions so far? Anything on skin we've covered? Skin is more than just the epidermis and the dermis. It is an organ system, and being an organ system means it contains multiple types of tissues. There are some accessory structures that contribute to what our skin does. So now we're going to turn our attention to hair, nails, and glands. All right, so near the top of page 57, let's talk about the location of hair. Hair is found on all body parts except for... Good. That's at least two good places, palms and soles. I'm going to add a couple for you. Lips.
Areola.
Good. So the nipple area has no hair. Eyelids actually do have tiny, tiny hairs. Yeah. One more. Genitals. Yeah, external genitals. Okay, so palms, soles, lips, the areola, which is a portion of the breast tissue, that's the nipple, and then, of course, external genitals. So no baby ever wanted a mouthful of hair while nursing, right? It makes sense why there is no hair in certain locations. Of course, grip is a big issue on hands and feet. You know, breastfeeding is a big issue for having no hair on the areola. And also with the lips, we don't necessarily want to have food coming into our mouth through a net of hair that's on our lips. So imagine, you know, trying to pull that out as you're trying to eat. So everywhere else, though, is covered with hairs. And there's actually two different kinds of hairs we'll talk about. Some that are very visible that you can see, like the hairs on your head, versus teeny tiny hairs that are elsewhere. So we'll talk about the difference between those. All hairs grow from a follicle. So I'd like to show you what a follicle is. What is the deepest layer of your epidermis?
Basal.
Basal, yeah. So normally stratum basal is sitting up there in the epidermis. And when we looked at previous pictures, it looked like that's where it stayed. So let me get you a good picture from earlier. This is a great one. See, this is all stratum basal. That's the bottommost layer of your epidermis. And all it does is groove here with your lower dermis. But then when I show you a picture that has hair, one like this one here, you'll notice these hair follicles. Look how deep that pokes down all the way into the hypodermis. Here's another one and another one sticking way down there. So when you look at a picture like this up close, this is in fact stratum basal. It travels all the way around the bottom side of your hair, and it is in fact what gives rise to your hair root or hair bulb. So it really does dive deep down into your deeper portions of the skin. I know it's hard to see here, but around that hair is a hair follicle, and that hair follicle is made up of stratum basal. So back when we discussed the job of the cells in stratum basal, what were those cells doing?
Oh, dividing.
Dividing, good. So they divide to make new skin at the topmost region, and those cells also divide to make new hairs. So you've got to have intact hair follicles in order for hair growth to occur. If you damage the hair follicle, what happens to your potential for hair growth?
It stops.
Exactly. So that's your blank there. If you damage the hair follicle, hair growth will stop. So in people who want to permanently end hair growth, you know, let's say that somebody has armpit hair that they don't want anymore, or facial hair that they don't want anymore, or even leg hair they don't want anymore. If they're tired of removing that hair through some other mechanism, such as plucking or shaving or waxing, then you can say, all right, do electrolysis, and that will kill those follicles from producing further hairs. That is the only way to permanently end hair growth. It's to kill that follicle. So they actually say that plucking, repetitive plucking, can damage the follicle. So, yeah, that's something that I guess a follicle just says, all right, I'm done. You know, I'm tired of being manipulated. But, yeah, most of the time, you know, shaving and those other kinds of things don't necessarily kill the follicle. All right, so the follicle is going to provide support for a hair root. And the hair root is this deepest portion of the hair that's a little fat in there. Right there it is. It is sometimes called the hair bulb. Okay? So hair root or hair bulb arises from that deep portion of the follicle. If you've ever looked at the hairs that have come out of your head, sometimes they have a little fat ending on them, so you know that that particular hair actually got the root when it fell out. So the root is what gives rise to the shaft. That's this portion that emerges and sticks up above the surface of your skin. Now, if you damage the root, can your hair grow back?
Yes.
Yes. Yep, if you damage the root, that hair falls out, but another can grow in its place. So the next question on your worksheet says, how is hair growth affected if the root is damaged and the hair falls out? It can regrow. Okay, so if the root is damaged, that particular hair may be done, it may fall out, but then you'll have a new hair grow as long as your follicle is intact. Let me take a quick detour for you, not on your worksheet, just something I think is fun information to know. Your hair follicles cycle on and off. They'll cycle on and they'll be active and they'll grow for some determined amount of time. Your genes will tell the follicle to grow for like 6 months. So your hair is pumping out new growth in that particular follicle for like 6 months. Then the genes say, okay, take a rest follicle. So the follicle sits there and it rests. And it's during that resting period that your hair stops growing and potentially can fall out of your head at that point or out of the rest of your body. So they cycle on, they grow like crazy, and then they'll take a rest and they'll cycle off. And if you think about the millions of hairs on your head, you know, some are on that rest cycle, some are on the on cycle. So some are growing, some are resting. When we start experiencing hair loss is when we've got more hair follicles doing what?
Resting.
Resting, yeah. So unfortunately, genes can drive that too, especially for males. There's a male pattern baldness issue there. And so the more those follicles rest, the more likely those hairs are to fall out. So I just thought that'd be kind of an interesting tidbit of information to know. Okay, so we've got, in summary, three parts to our hair. We have a follicle that provides root, I can talk, provides growth. Where did that word even come from? It's not Monday, it's Wednesday, right? Okay, so there is that follicle that provides growth for the root, okay? And what type of tissue makes up that follicle? You have it.
Epithelial.
Epithelial, it sure is. And what specific region of your epidermis is that follicle?
Oh,
Stratum basal, good. And the root itself down here is also known as a bulb, and that particular portion grows at the leisure or at the mercy of that hair follicle. So here's your hair bulb down here, and then what ends up sticking up above the hair or above the skin line is shaft, good. Okay, so let me give you a couple more blanks there. Hair is also made of keratin. No surprise there, right? And what about the pigment? Melanin. Yeah, you're close yet. Made of keratin, and the pigmentation is melanin. So speaking of melanin, I did want to show you this. So you've got hair with color down here at the bottom, and then here's hair with no color. That's, of course, a gray or a white hair. What happens over time is the gray hairs are genetically predetermined. You know, if your mom or dad went gray or white-headed early, you know, chances are that you may have inherited that early gray or white hair gene as well. Gray and white hairs are totally different structurally from regular colored hairs. They, in fact, have no melanin, and on top of that, they have air pockets. It is the air pockets inside that make them incredibly unruly. If you start getting gray hairs, you'll notice that they behave different from everybody else on your head. So your hair may be laying like normal, and then here's this gray hair that's it's doing its job. So that's why they are also hard to take dye. You know, it's easier to dye hair with color because those gray hairs, you know, they just behave all on their own because they've got those air pockets on the inside. Probably so, yeah, because they're totally structured different than a regular hair, yeah. Probably so.
My husband has some in his beard, and he's like, this thing is just, I'm not really, it's just a little bit, y'all, just a teeny little bit. This thing is just blood and ruling.
So they do have their mind of their own. I thought you'd be interested in seeing straight hairs versus curly hairs, straight on the left, curly on the right. And you probably also know that throughout your lifetime, your hair follicles may change shape, and the texture of your hair may change over your lifetime. So if you start out life with curly hair, it may relax throughout your life, or it may go the other direction from straight hair to more curly hair. So it depends on the shape of the follicle, round, you know, for straight hair. If your follicles become a little more almond-shaped, then that can produce curly hairs. So kind of interesting that those follicles can actually change throughout your lifetime. Let's see, erector pili muscle is our next one on the list. This is a muscle here that's attached to that hair follicle. And what is the job of that erector pili muscle? Makes your hair stand on end, good. Why in the world do you need this to happen? Trap heat, yeah. So I know it's not terribly noticeable, but if you have goosebumps and your hair stand on end, the whole goal is to help trap heat closer to your body. So those erector pili muscles do exactly as their name implies. Erect means to stand straight. What is pili? It's a hair, yes. So erector pili says, hey hair, stand up straight, and that traps the heat closer to the body surface. So are you more likely to have those erector pili muscles to operate when you're hot or when you're cold?
Cold,
yeah. So just FYI, just another bit of trivia, it is smooth muscle. Those erector pili do operate involuntarily. You know, you can't make your hair stand on end by thinking about it. All right, so two types of hairs here. We have terminal hairs on our head and our eyebrows. Where else do we have terminal hairs?
Armpits.
Armpits.
Eyelashes,
yeah. Pubic hair, yeah. So these are colored hairs. They are pigmented. They're easy to see, and they're often more heavy duty than a vellus hair. These teeny tiny vellus hairs are transparent. They're not usually pigmented, and they're pretty much everywhere on your body except for those hairless regions we mentioned earlier. So I know that you probably don't spend a lot of time looking at the inside of your arm, and it in fact is not hair-free, but there are teeny tiny peach fuzz hairs. They're called vellus hairs. When you were a small kid, you had vellus hairs in your armpit, you have them in your pubic region, but when puberty hits, those vellus hairs are then transformed into terminal hairs. So, you know, once puberty has passed, then we expect to see terminal hairs in those locations. Sure.
So, you know, you have a very hairy arm?
Right.
Is that still considered vellus hairs?
Still considered vellus hairs, yeah. Yeah, even though it may, it's not going to look, I don't mean to be gross, but it's not going to look like pubic hair. But yeah, there's a difference there in the texture and the structure, you might say, of those two hairs. Yeah.
So facial hair is terminal hair,
right? In a male, it would be, yeah. In a female, most likely all of that is vellus hair. Yeah. That's a really good point to make. Yeah, it depends on what sex we are. Let's see, nails are next, and they're remarkably similar to hair, except that they contain some cartilage, which, that explains what.
Why it hurts when you break a nail.
And why they bend a little, yeah. So they're meant to be rubbery a little bit, a little flexible, and yeah, there is a bed there that gives you the pain if you happen to bend or break those nails. So it is not just keratin in our nails, but we also have cartilage in there too. So that gives us a little bit of that rubbery flexibility. Let's see. Your blank there for nails is actually cuticle. You know what your cuticles are, right? Girls know. You push your cuticles back. Okay.
They talk about it. I'm not sure what it is.
What is it? Okay, so if you look around where the base of your nail bed is, you'll notice a moon-shaped structure. That is not it. That's actually something called a lunula. But this skin right through here is what we think of as your cuticle. And if you don't push it back, sometimes you get a hangnail, you know, a little piece of skin that hangs off that can be very painful. So it's meant to protect the nail bed, and it can grow up over the skin if you don't keep it pushed back or over the nail. What's that?
I thought that was skin. I thought that was a nail.
Yeah, that's it's really tough skin, yeah. Yep. Let's see. I did want to mention to you that nails and hair are really kind of similar in how they grow. In this picture, you get a look at the nail root down here embedded up underneath that cuticle. And that's where the nail growth occurs from. But just like the hair, there is a nail follicle. And it's made up of what layer of the epidermis?
Stratum
basal, yeah. So all around here is stratum basal. That is what we consider our nail follicle. And then this stuff right here, that's the beginning of the nail root, or nail bulb, I guess you would say. And then, of course, that's where nail growth occurs from. I think we've probably all been in the unfortunate situation of closing a finger in a door. If you are unfortunate enough to have it really badly done, you may have damaged this nail root. And in that case, what happens to the nail?
Doesn't
grow right, does it? It may in fact fall off. And the good news is, as long as your follicle is intact, your nail will regrow. But if you happen to have damaged both root and follicle, then what happens to your nail? Stops growing, yeah. So if you damage the follicle, whether it's hair or nails, then you've permanently damaged the growth potential for that body part. Sure.
A lot of people that like close their fingers in the door, whatever, they have like the blood shot that they have, and they say they relieve the pressure somewhat. What are they sticking with? Well, what part of the nail are they sticking into?
If they're relieving the pressure, they might just be poking through the nail. The nail itself, I'd personally be concerned about that for the introduction of bacteria and then getting an infection. And then, ouch, that has to be very painful if you get an infection under your nail. Yeah. I had a student several years ago, and she explained that her grandmother was tired of having ingrown toenails. I mean, aren't we all? I mean, if you've ever had one, they're awful. And so she decided that she would have all her toenails removed. So, oh. All of them.
That is way
off
my mind.
I know.
She really did that.
So yeah. They did not grow back.
So you just paint skin?
She painted skin. I guess she did. Yeah. So what did she have damaged down there? Her follicles. Yeah. Yeah.
Could she wear certain shoes?
I guess she could.
I would be so hurting.
Oh, seriously. And if you stumped your toe, there's nothing there to stop you from, like,
I would die if I had my
toe. Oh, I know. That had to be very painful.
My friend's grandma had her toenails removed because of the same reason. But her toenails were right back, like, really thin.
Oh, really? She's had it done. Yeah. Okay, about halfway down your page, let's hit those glands down there. We've got different types of exocrine glands. I just want to clarify that you'll talk about exocrine in this class and endocrine in Bio 211. What does the prefix exo tell you?
Outside.
Good. Of course, endocrine glands release their secretions
inside.
Yeah. So there are two major types of glands down there. We've got sweat glands and oil glands. The sweat glands are alternately known as sudoriferous, and I'll tell you there's a hidden clue there. When you say the word sudoriferous, I almost hear the word odor hidden in there. We normally associate odor with sweat glands. Okay, and there's two types. Yeah, you got it. So the first one there, associated with hair follicles, is apocrine or apocrine, however you'd like to say it. And the second blank is for eccrine. So I want to point out something. These two types of sweat glands are totally different. In fact, they're so different they release two different types of sweat. The apocrine or apocrine gland is always going to be associated with a hair follicle. I'll tell you an easy way to keep this straight. You see the word ape in there, right? Okay, so apes are hairy, and apocrine or apocrine glands always are associated with hairs. And the hairs we're talking about are normally the ones in your stinky regions, your armpit, your groin. And apocrine sweat is actually a milky, creamy sweat.
Ew.
And it's not meant to cool you off. It's not that type of sweat. We actually think it has other functions that are yet to be discovered. There's been a little bit of research done about pheromones. You may have heard of those before. A lot of animals use pheromones, so why not us? How do dogs identify each other?
Smell
those pheromones, yeah. How do dogs identify us?
Smell our
butt. Welcome home, let me sniff you. Okay, that's you. So there must be chemicals in those pheromones or in those sweat molecules that have some kind of identifier as to who we are. So right now they say they don't fully understand what apocrine sweat is there for. We do fully understand, though, what eccrine sweat is there for. What does it do to you?
Cool
you down. Good. And where are eccrine sweat glands found?
Skin.
Pretty much everywhere, right? All over your skin. So what do you find in eccrine sweat? Water, electrolytes, waste products, yeah. So let me explain why sudoriferous glands are sometimes called, you know, the stinky glands. And it has to do with those waste products that we excrete in the Eccrine sweat glands. Those waste products are often things like urea, some proteins, and bacteria that live on your skin love to eat those particular waste products. The more those bacteria eat, the more they reproduce, and the more they poop, and it is the bacterial poop that makes us have a particular odor. So it's not the fact that we're sweating. Sweat itself has no odor, but it's the bacterial relationship with our skin that gives us the odor. So some people eat foods that those bacteria love, and they may have more of a potent odor than others. And our relationship with bacteria is different. They've even swiped people's hands, and we have different bacteria populations on right hand versus left hand. So that may explain why some of us have body odor issues and others have pretty much no body odor issues. There's a whole spectrum there that may depend on the bacteria living on your skin. So, you know, it's not your fault. It's the bacteria, right? Yep, so bacteria, they're discovering, are actually very important. They're very responsible for our, you know, how our bodies function and, you know, outside versus inside. They're located in both places. Let's see, ceruminous glands are earwax glands. They're modified sweat glands. And like all sweat glands, they're made of a layer of, single layer, of simple cuboidal epithelial tissue. Okay, where do you find mammary glands?
Breast milk,
good. So breast tissue contains mammary glands. They too are modified sweat glands. Let's turn our attention to the oil glands at the bottom of the page. These are otherwise known as sebaceous glands. Likewise, oil is sometimes known as sebum. So these are always associated with a hair. There's your blank. These are always associated with a hair. The function of oil is to do what? Good. Lubricate and waterproof skin and hair. Lubricate and waterproof skin and hair. Lubricate and waterproof skin and hair. And let me add one for you. It inhibits bacterial growth. So it stops or inhibits bacterial growth.
So if you have oily skin, is that actually a good thing?
It's a good thing. Not only for keeping us waterproofed and moist and keeping our hair from breaking, but also for inhibiting, you know, bacteria from invading that deeper portion of our skin. So I know we kind of find oily skin to be uncomfortable, but cumbersome, yeah. But in fact, it's actually very good and very healthy for our skin. So, you know, 100 years ago, how often did people wash their hair, take a bath?
Not often,
right? You know, nowadays, compared to, say, 100 years ago, we're probably extremely clean compared to their standards, right?
That was a monthly celebration.
Oh, right.
Once a month,
yeah. Could you imagine once a month?
Yeah.
I mean, imagine how bad people must have smelled, right?
Well, they probably didn't smell it because they all smell it.
That's true.
They all went to the same water.
Yeah.
I mean, the smell of their bodies was probably the least of their worries because, remember, no toilets. So where did the
That's true. Go? That's true. And infection and death was much more a realistic thing.
Yeah.
So by taking frequent baths or hand washing, you know, how many places can you go that they don't have a sign saying, wash your hands, you know, employees wash their hands. It's everywhere we go, wash your hands, wash your hands. So what are we washing away? Okay, and?
Viruses.
And what are we making that we're washing away? And oil. Yeah. So, you know, if we're washing constantly, we're washing away that protective layer of oil. and then go to the store, and what do they sell? Lotion. It's a vicious cycle there. We do know that if your skin dries out, it peels, there's more likely
cracks.
Cracks, yeah. And then what are we more at risk for?
Infection,
yes. So it's just a vicious cycle that we're on. We're obviously more keen about infection than we are about having, you know, or more keen about having cleanliness and lacking infection than we are about having the oil on our skin. Same thing with our hair. You know, we replenish our lost oils there with things like moisturizers, creams, and conditioners. So, yeah, we're definitely a society that values cleanliness over having the oils on our skin. Just a last little bit there, acne at the very bottom of your page can produce blackheads and whiteheads. And the difference is whether or not skin grows over the top of the inflamed oil gland. In this picture, you can see skin is growing over the top. Inflammation is occurring in the oil gland beneath. And this would be a whitehead because the skin is growing and trapping that pus underneath. You know, the temptation, of course, is to pop this, let the pus drain, because technically this is an abscess. Blackheads are same thing. It's still inflammation or collection of dirt and melanin down in the oil gland. But in this case, there is no skin growing over the top that traps that inflammation in the gland. So there is not the temptation to pop the pus out of that particular inflammation. All right, so that should take us down to the bottom of page 57. It sounds like a good time for a break. And then we'll wrap up this chapter in about 10 minutes. Why don't we come back about 9:10? Okay, top of page 60. We have about 3 pages in this chapter to wrap up. Okay, so this page is all about skin functions, and then we're going to talk about skin disorders in the next few pages. Here on the top of page 60, let's kind of summarize what the skin does for us in terms of protection. So we know that secretions like oil help to prevent bacterial infection. What else does the skin do to help protect underlying tissues? Good. Yeah, UV rays. Of course, melanin there helps protect from incoming damage. We also have keratin, which is there to toughen the outermost portion of our skin. What else does keratin do?
Waterproof.
Waterproofs, good. And then also Langerhans cells. What do they help do for us? Good. They eat bacteria. They help protect the skin from microbes. They eat bacteria, sure do. They're exactly right. Phagocytes, that's right. So the next major issue about the skin is its job is to produce vitamin D. And to be specific, it's called vitamin D3. And the alternate name for vitamin D3 is called calcitriol. They say that we can sit in the sun something like 15 to 30 minutes per day and make enough vitamin D3 to give us strong and healthy bones. So it's kind of a crazy thought. You know, we don't think of ourselves as plants. Why do we need sunlight, right? But the sunlight is for the bone health. And what we're going to learn as we progress through this course is that bone health is related to muscle health. So it all drives in together. So the lighter your skin, the less time you need. The darker your skin, the more time you may need in the sun to make enough vitamin D3. Where else can we get vitamin D3 from?
Milk,
yeah. So dairy products. Milk, of course, is a good source of vitamin D3. So if you avoid the sun, then this can be another way to get enough for your daily requirements.
What about sunny D?
What's that?
What about sunny D?
Oh, cow. I haven't read the label on that. I have to check the label on that one.
I thought it was because it was like, I'm giving you the D that the sun can't give you.
Maybe that is the case. Maybe that's the D there, right?
Yeah.
Sure.
So how does that work with your thyroid, your vitamin D? What's that? Because oftentimes, you know, people with thyroid issues have vitamin D deficiency. So what's the correlation?
I don't know if there is one or if it just happens to be a coincidence. I don't know of any link between those two particular hormones.
Okay.
Not direct link. It may be through other mechanisms that are linked. Yeah. I'll read up on that and see what I can find.
So I have thyroid issues, so then I always want to check my blood pressure. Periodically.
I have
a couple times a year to kind of, do it. I know some medical doctors, when you're doing your physical, they're going to check your vitamin levels, and so many people aren't having conditions.
Right.
But I was just wondering, that D3 is always, I'm not always.
I'm hybrid thyroid too, but I haven't had my D checked. But I'm thinking it's for heart health because they're finding this vitamin D all that time. So maybe they're just two things they're checking for, but not necessarily
correlation.
Maybe not.
Yeah. I have that as well. So I have
high bone.
And they give me the vitamin D supplements. They used to give me a lot of it to have out of And then as that progressed, they gave it to me once a month.
Oh, interesting. I'll have to check into that.
I take it too.
Okay. Well, you need to give me something to look up. I have to check into that.
Okay. You email me?
I'll email you, yes. Yeah.
Yes. I'll look it up too.
Okay. I want to tell you something interesting about the sunlight. We know we get darker the longer we sit in the sun, and we know that that's about protecting the underlying tissues. But here's a cool thing about that. The longer you sit in the sun, technically, the more vitamin D3 you're making, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the darkness that we experience when we sit in the sun for a very long time is not just about preventing sun damage to the lower tissue levels, it's also about preventing you from making too much vitamin D. So, we've always heard there's too much of a good thing.
Right.
There's apparently a perfect amount of sun exposure to give you D3, and then excess sun exposure apparently is going to be detrimental. So not just for skin damage, but also for D3 production. So, sitting in the sun for 2 hours won't necessarily give you ramped up strong bones that are incredibly tough. Sitting there longer may, in fact, not do much more for your bones than sitting there for 20 minutes. So, interesting.
Can you call that a negative feedback? Is there darkness?
I probably would, yeah, because the negative feedback is to inhibit excess production of D3. Exactly. That's a great example. Let's see. We've got various types of sensory receptors that are found in our skin, not just dermis, but also in the epidermis. So I'd like to take you through several of the types of sensations that we can experience. So you notice that we've got something there called a tactile receptor. Its fancy name is Merkel disc or Meissner corpuscle. These are various types of our receptors. These types of receptors pick up on fine touch. And by fine touch, I mean something like a mosquito landing on your arm. You think something's there, you're not quite sure, you look, sure enough it's there, that's fine touch. Pressure may be gentle or pressure may be deep. If somebody grabs a hold of your arm and really sinks in their fingers, that's going to be a deep pressure. There is a specific type of receptor for deep pressure, and it's a lamellated one. But just light pressure may be something that our Meissner corpuscles can pick up on. So vibrations are not just something our ears detect. Vibrations can also be felt through our skin, which is why someone who is hard of hearing or deaf may experience the beat of music simply through their skin and, of course, not through their ears. So, yeah, we do feel vibrations through these tactile receptors. What do you notice about the shape of this next one, the deep pressure receptor? Looks like an oval, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And if you were to push down on the top, what would happen to the shape?
Bounce back.
It would distort it, right? And then you're right, it would bounce back when you let go. So anytime you feel deep pressure, then you're going to distort those lamellated receptors, and then we have a sensation of deep pressure. Tooth extraction is one time where we may experience this. Or, if somebody's doing surgery and you can feel something going on, or grabbing your arm and pushing deeply, those are going to distort those lamellated receptors. Take a look at the Ruffini corpuscle, and again, look at the shape of the receptor. Look how it spreads out like tree roots in the skin. So what is this one going to detect?
Pressure and distortion.
So again, light pressure this time, but if your skin gets pulled, you can see how those receptors are going to get pulled further apart. That, again, is going to prevent us from doing what to the skin?
Tearing.
Yeah, tearing the skin. So Those receptors are hopefully meant to prevent tearing. Which specific region of the skin is not going to heal well if you do tear it?
The dermis.
The dermis, yes. So there's a very good reason we want to know about potential skin tears. It's for that dermis. So you'll want to be able to identify these receptors, these three pictured here. And you'll also want to know what types of sensations are available in our skin. Obviously, our skin doesn't see and our skin doesn't hear, but we do pick up on all sorts of information through our skin, including temperature, which we're heading to next.
You said be able to identify them, and what did you say?
Be able to identify them and then know what types of sensations we experience in our skin. Anybody else need to sign in? All right. Let's see. Our next topic at the bottom of the page is regulation of body temperature. And, of course, skin is vitally important for helping us maintain a regular temperature, typically around 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, give or take a degree or two. On the Celsius scale, normal body temperature is around 37 degrees Celsius. So I'd like to talk to you about the blood vessels in our skin. Which portion of your skin is avascular?
Epidermis,
good. And the blood vessels that we do have are found deep in the dermis. Do you see a good reason for having no vessels in the epidermis? You bleed all the time, right? Okay, so you're constantly losing skin cells from that upper layer, and that doesn't work very well with having a blood supply directly through that layer. So the dermis does have vessels. The blood and nutrients serve the epidermis by diffusion, and likewise, heat can be lost through our epidermis as well. So I want to introduce two terms that you're going to hear about extensively in Bio 211. These have to do with the diameter of a vessel. You've got vasoconstriction, which you'll notice narrows a blood vessel, and then we've got vasodilation. Now what happens to the blood flow? Good. Open it up, allow more blood flow in. Good. So let's target on your worksheet what happens when we have a drop in body temperature when we're too cold.
Muscles contract.
Shivering, good. And that helps us to generate heat. Okay, so muscles start to shiver to produce heat. What happens to your sweat glands when you're cold? They don't release sweat. Yeah, they're either on or they're off. And when you're cold, they're off. Or at least they should be, right? You probably sweated when you've been cold before, and then, oh no, you're sick when that happens, right?
Yes.
Next bullet point says vasoconstriction reduces flow of blood. So vasoconstriction reduces flow of blood. So along those same lines, if you reduce the flow of blood from the upper dermis regions to the lower dermis regions, the upper regions aren't getting enough oxygen. Yeah, you got it. So that's why cold skin appears blue, not getting enough oxygen. Okay, so cold skin appears blue because that skin is not getting enough oxygen. And one more issue here when we're cold, what does that erector pili muscle do?
Traps
heat. Good. Stands hairs on end, traps heat. Just a little bit of trivia here for you. Anybody from the north moved south?
Yeah.
How was your first summer here?
I'm hating it right now.
This is your first summer here.
It sucks, yes.
Okay. And then I hate to tell you, but it gets worse, right?
Okay.
I like walked outside and got sweat that wasn't mine. So I'm going to have to write a letter to whoever runs this out.
Right. Because
you need to like have air conditioning in every single home because this is ridiculous.
And it's suffocating, isn't it?
And it's humid. Like, in New York, we have heat, but we have, like, a dryish heat. You don't have to worry about getting other people's sweat.
Right, right. And you make an important point. Because we have the humidity, our sweat doesn't evaporate as easily, so we don't feel as cool as you would in a dry environment. You also mentioned you moved here. How was your first summer here?
Actually, we go back for the summer.
So. Oh, do you? That's
right,
the smart thing to do, right? Anybody else move here from up north?
I moved up north, and I hated it.
So. Okay, so how was your first winter?
I lived in upstate New York.
So oh.
It was like 9 months of straight snow.
Ouch.
Yes.
And I'm sure you were colder than anybody else in that area.
Definitely.
So the cool thing, a reason I wanted to ask you guys about, you know, where you've lived and stuff, is when you live in a hot environment like the South, and you're used to the hot temperatures, and if you've lived here your whole life, you actually have blood vessels built upper in the dermis that are used to carrying away your excess heat. And so for those of you who have moved to the South and spent summers here and are not used to the summers, your bodies actually don't have vessels built up there. Your vessels are built in the lower portions of your dermis. They say it takes at least a year's time to adjust the blood flow and build new vessels in the right location. So if you go north and spend a winter there, you've got all these vessels up here that are used to radiating heat, and you freeze to death the first winter. Likewise, those who move south and spend your first hot summer here, you don't have enough vessels to radiate and lose the heat. So I just thought that would be some interesting trivia to know. Let's talk about what happens when you're too hot near the bottom of your page. This time, what kind of glands activate?
Sweat glands.
Sweat glands, good. Eccrine sweat glands activate. How does vasodilation help us? Good, increases the blood flow. So this time our capillaries open up. We let more blood flow toward the upper dermis regions. That allows the radiation of heat to be lost from our bodies. And of course, if you're hot, then your skin may appear red or pink in color. So what does that have to do with? What does that indicate?
More blood.
And what does that blood carry?
Oxygen,
yes. So it's the increased blood flow and the increased oxygen. So hot skin appears red due to increased blood flow and increased oxygen. And then finally down there, unfortunately, if we are so hot and we sweat so much, we can experience something called a heat stroke. So what has stopped happening if you head into heat stroke territory?
Sweating.
Sweating, yeah. So what happens during a heat stroke? We stop sweating. And if you stop sweating, what happens to your body temperature?
It rises,
yes. Yeah. So your body temperature continues to increase. So you probably know that dogs don't have sweat glands, and of course they can't sweat like we do to reduce their body temperature. So how do they get rid of their excess heat?
Panting,
yeah, get it out through their breath. So yeah, there's multiple ways to lose body temperature. Breathing is one of them, but we're fortunate that we have those sweat glands. All right, so that should do it for page 60. Do y'all have any questions there, anything I can help you with? I would look over that, especially for things like dermis, epidermis. Look at the glands, the erector pili muscle in that picture. About heat stroke. That's it. And we die when our heat gets to about 108, our body temp gets that hot. But yeah. Let's see, top of page 61, I promised we would come full circle to wound healing. This time we're talking about healing a wound specific to your skin. And like any kind of damaged tissue, the first thing that happens is inflammation. All right, so what are the four classic signs of inflammation?
Red, hot, swelling, and pain.
Good, red, hot, swelling, and pain. Okay, so four classic signs of inflammation include redness, heat, swelling, and pain. And as irritating as we find inflammation to be, it's actually meant to be helpful for the skin because we're bringing in healing agents that are involved in our steps 2 and 3, migratory phase and proliferation phase. So we need white blood cells to travel in. How do they help us?
They attack any kind of infection that might get sick.
Good, attack infections, microbes. Okay, and then we also have fibroblasts that migrate in. What are they going to do for us?
Regrowth
fibers, good. Now, when we're talking about regrowing fibers, that implies a specific region of the skin has been damaged. Epidermis or dermis?
Dermis.
Dermis, yeah. Okay, so it takes time, of course, to heal. We re-knit the skin back together after it's been damaged. The scab should be lost. And eventually what we should be doing is a maturing phase where we really kind of let the skin continue to heal after the scab has been removed. So even after a scab falls off, you may still continue to have some fix and repair processes going on inside. If the tissue has been damaged greatly, if there's been a fairly bad scar that sets up for your tissue, what does scar tissue contain?
Collagen.
Collagen, good. And if you have scar tissue left behind that doesn't fully convert to normal tissue, well, if you're talking dermis, what does that mean you no longer have there?
Blood supply.
Blood supply. What about nerves? Nerves could be damaged, yeah. How about the stretchiness or flexibility of your skin if you have scar tissue? Yeah, it's not stretchy, right? So the unfortunate thing is if you have scar tissue that also affects your epidermis, you don't produce what types of secretions? Sweat. So now what's your problem if you don't sweat?
Hot,
yeah, so issues with body temp regulation. What else may you not produce in your skin?
Sensory
reception, right? So you may have difficulty feeling in that particular area. What other glandular secretion might you not produce? Oils. So what happens to that skin?
More bacteria,
it's dry.
No hair,
yeah. So all around, scar tissue left in the skin is a bad deal. It doesn't leave us with any of the normal sensations or functions that skin should have.
I've answered all of my questions for the past 15 years.
Well, that's good.
I had like a really huge scar on my thigh from when my femur was split.
Ooh.
And I wondered why I could not feel there, why I didn't sweat there, sweat around my leg, but not there. I'd have like it felt weird. It was always different than from the rest of my surrounding skin, and I wasn't really sure why.
Yep, every skin function is gone. Yep, sure is. Well, that's good to know. Question answered then. Speaking of all these issues, burns can produce the same effect as scar tissue. In fact, severe burns can lead to scar tissue. So let's turn our attention to burns at this point. We're always concerned about burns because of fluid loss. You know, skin is a protective barrier that prevents dehydration. It also means that we've lost our protective covering. No melanin, no keratinocytes, you know, looking at all of those protective issues that the skin does for us. Now we've got an open wound that microbes can invade. They say the first 24 hours after a burn, your skin is sterile, but ooh, after 24 hours, now you've got an environment that is going to be hosting microbes and bacterial growth. And then this is a really bad issue with, say, burns. Proteins can be denatured from the heat of a burn, and then cells can die. So then we're having to remove or debris that damaged area. So a lot of real serious issues come about with burns. For that reason, we have this thing called the Rule of Nines, and it's a way for us to estimate how much of the body's been burned. It's based on the number 9. You'll notice the front and the back of the arms add up to 9%. The trunk is a feature of 9. It's 18% on the front, 18% on your back. Each leg is 9% on the front, on the back again 9%. So if you hear someone has been burned over, say, 50% of the body, they're using this as a guide to estimate exactly what has been burned and how much of the body's been burned. So for instance, if this entire leg was burned on the front only, we'd say about 9% of the body's been burned. If both legs were burned on the front, about what percent's been burned?
18.
Yeah, so about 18. Look at how much damage could be done from a trunk burn. That's also 18%. So it kind of gives us an idea of how much we're looking at. I'd like to mention that burns are measured by depth of burn. So a first degree is less deep than a second, than a third, than a fourth.
Does the rule of nines apply for children as well?
Children as well, yeah.
But is it different numbers?
I wouldn't think so. We're still proportioned the same as a kid, so I would think it's probably the same setup, I would imagine. Yeah. Okay, so epidermis is what's affected first as we're burned, and that would be a first degree. If you burn through the dermis, that's now a second degree. If you reach as far as the subcutaneous or hypodermis layer, that's third. And then what typically is beneath that is muscle, so that's a fourth degree. So all we're doing is numbering the layers, 1, 2, 3, and 4 for epidermis, dermis, hypodermis, and underlying muscle tissue. So hopefully that'll help you keep straight when you're talking about the various degrees of burns. Which one of these do you think is the least severe? And most severe? Fourth degree. Notice there's no 0-degree burn and there's no 5th-degree burn. It's just 1, 2, 3, or 4.
I was doing one of the quizzes and that was on there.
What type of burn?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What type of burn has these characteristics?
That's good. That's good. That'll be on the test too.
What was the question?
She said that was on the quiz.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The question was, which burn burns through the epidermis and the dermis and has no pain? Or like, we have the pain?
Third degree, yeah. Yeah, sure is. I just want to mention that burns are not just sunburn. You know, there's chemical burns. There are electrical burns, hot water burns. What else am I missing?
Radiation.
What's that?
Radiation.
Radiation burns. Yeah. Okay, so in the case of a burn, whether it's sun or whatever, it's simply affecting the epidermis. Inflammation occurs, and so we experience those 4 cardinal signs of red, hot, swollen, painful skin. And you're going to experience that until the inflammation goes away. So this case here is simply a first-degree burn, and the way I know it's not a second-degree burn is it has no what?
Blisters.
Blisters, yeah. So second-degree burns are more severe. They do affect the epidermis and the underlying dermis to some degree. They do have blisters, and that is what differentiates a first from a second-degree burn. What's the problem with having blisters?
Infection.
Infection, exactly. So some pretty severe-looking second-degree burns here, some pretty nasty-looking blisters. So this may be a second degree burn around the blister, and then there may be varying first degree burns elsewhere.
So when someone has sunburning, they have second degree sunburn?
If it's an actual honest to goodness blister, then yeah, it would be that. In some cases, sun poisoning could be an allergic reaction. So if there's no blisters and rather just a rash, then that might not be a second degree burn. It just depends if it's truly a blister burn. Yeah.
Question, is there such thing as a friction burn? Like, I know a lot of people talk about carpet burns.
Yeah, like carpet burn, road rash, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine that's a type of, like, inflammation, probably more like a first degree.
Okay.
I'm not sure that a friction burn or friction would cause in some cases it might cause a blister. So, yeah, maybe it would be in that second degree territory.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have a
question. Sure.
So, you know, like, when you get in a car accident, the airbag coming out and that burns, what kind of burn would that be?
If it's just inflammation, it's probably chemical, and it's probably just a first degree.
Mm-hmm.
I would doubt that it would cause blisters. But, yeah, I'm thinking it's probably a chemical burn. Let's see. These are a combination of second and third degree burns. The second degree would be this area around here that probably had some blisters. But this region through here is a third degree burn. In the case of a third-degree burn is we've not only burned through epidermis, we burned through the entire dermis, and now we're burning hypodermis, yeah. So why are third-degree burns not painful?
Burn the nerves.
Yeah, you got it. Burn the nerves off, right. another third degree burn.
Don't they usually do like skin grafting to repair that?
They do skin grafting, yes, they sure do.
I don't understand that. We had cadaver skin put on a thigh. She was running around the table and knocked her hot chocolate and it spilled on the leg. And so I ended up putting a burn dressing on it, wrapping it, and took her to the emergency room. So we they didn't bother it. We had to take her to Charlotte.
Wow.
And, they just degreased it. They just got like a nice little sponge type thing, and they removed that old skin, put that cadaver skin on top of it real quick, wrapped her up real good, and she couldn't be exposed to other people for 2 weeks. And it took perfectly.
Oh,
and
wow.
You can't tell. You can't tell. If you look at her leg, you can tell the difference.
So they put it on immediately as soon as you
No, I think it took us a minute. They tried Silvadine. We put Silvadine on it for a little while until I could see the doctor from Charlotte. It's the Burn Center in what is it, Atlanta, Augusta, wherever.
Mm-hmm.
They also have a place in Charlotte. So, yeah, we put Silvadine on it for a week until our appointment. And once we got there, they just cleaned it, put that cadaver skin on it. It looks like a little door jar.
What's that cadaver skin?
Skin from a dead person, a body, put it on there, it took perfect.
Well, that's good.
She didn't remove the take skin from another area of her body or anything.
Well, that's not the
body. $8,000 for that skin,
That's good.
Because the doctor, the ER doctor, is very concerned about, like, she's a little girl, you know, when she gets older, women have they're very concerned about their skin, and your legs do look good. And so he was like, no, let's just send her to Charlotte, and then no problem.
Well,
and they
use
that mesh pig skin.
Oh, yeah. Become one with pigs. Hey, if it heals it, great, you know. That's good.
We have no problem.
It must have taken it with no problem then.
No problem.
Wow.
I have a question. You know how they do skin grafts on people who are burning? Like they graft part of the skin from somewhere else?
Yeah.
What is the difference in doing that? You're still exposing. Like, if you cut a piece of skin off your leg, the cobra puts them on your arm, you're still exposing your leg.
You're right, you're going to create a sore or a wound there, but now you've got less rejection if you put it on your arm. I guess they don't take a certain thickness so that they allow regrowth to occur, because otherwise you're right, you've got another wound you've got to bring up. So it must not be at a certain depth. By the way, this is a water burn. That's incredible, but it's burned into the dermis down below, and below that into the hypodermis, and below that into the muscle tissue.
A water burn,
yeah. Yeah.
So
fourth degree. It could have been an accident, maybe something spilled on this person. So, yeah, I'm not thinking it's necessarily cooking related, but perhaps maybe some kind of accident.
Will those nerves come back? That won't come back.
That's probably all dead tissue.
So that's going to just, you might lose the hand?
Yeah, look at the fingertips.
That's what I was looking at.
Yeah, that's
probably going to lose.
That's probably amputated.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have speakers in here, but I did want to show you something just real quick. National Geographic ran something about 6 years ago called the skin gun. And what they actually do is they take your own skin cells and they put them into what looks like an air sprayer, and where a person has been burned, they actually take your own stem cells and spray it on. It's very cool stuff. This guy, actually, you can see his picture pop up there. He was burned in Afghanistan. There was an explosion, and his entire shoulder all the way down to here was, I think, a second or third degree burn, and they said, of course, he needed skin grafts. So what he did was he went to this trial clinic with a skin gun. They sprayed it on, and they show later on here. Let's see if I can find it. It'll play, but it's hard to hear.
An individual decided to throw a cup of gasoline on the fire. The worst part was my face. It was the whole right side of my face here. my ear, my neck, and my shoulder, and the entire top part of my arm.
Yerm had suffered severe second-degree burns. This photo shows what a second-degree burn looks like.
The arm kind of looked like a piece of charred meat, like a hot dog that was left on a grill too long. The doctor said that I might be a candidate for this new procedure, which is the spray gun, and asked me if I would be interested.
Skin cell spraying is like paint spraying. Just you need a more sophisticated device, like computer controlled. We isolate cells from the healthy part of the skin, the patient's own cells, which can be taken in a water solution, and that solution is prepared for cell spraying.
Basically, what they were doing was taking my stem cells from my skin and putting them all in the gun and spraying it on my arm.
Scientists have been able to regenerate sheets of skin for decades. The problem is it takes weeks for that skin to grow, and the new skin is extremely fragile. Gerlach's gun solves both of these problems.
It takes like 1.5 hours to take the biopsy, to isolate the cells, and to spray the cells.
This is what Yerm's skin probably looked like before treatment. This is what it looked like 4 days after it was sprayed with his own stem cells.
They did it on a Friday, and my follow-up was that Monday, and the burn unit said it was healed, completely healed.
Though the skin gun is still experimental, over a dozen patients have already been successfully treated.
I think not. I think it's just that good. I've actually tried to follow up and see if they have put that into like mainstream use. And what the video?
Oh yeah.
Oh, we're not watching that. What is this? This is educational. Okay. No, we're not watching that stuff. But if you guys would like to see the video again, there's the link in the PowerPoint. You can go on D2L and grab it out of the content. Yeah, I looked to see if they put this in mainstream use. It's been 6 years since that video came out, and apparently it just hasn't been mainstream. I'm thinking, gosh, all the people that have been burned would love to have that.
Absolutely. The procedure's probably really expensive.
Probably so.
Yeah, they probably That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, that lab was running that as an experiment at that time, so he wasn't... I think he was not the only one that got that benefit.
But some experimental stuff like that, they'll just do for free. I mean, they won't charge.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Just to see if it'll work.
Right.
I mean, just
to see. Yeah. Like, it's like stem cell research.
Right.
Exactly.
Like,
a lot of people who are paralyzed, they still haven't, the FDA hasn't approved any kind of stem cells.
Exactly.
They still have cases of people who recover from it.
Yes.
And you think, why don't they just mainstream that? It takes years.
Yeah. I guess it is
Last page of skin info is page 62 with skin cancer, so I'll run you through that one. Just to give you a little background, cancer is actually based in our genes, and this doesn't necessarily mean that you've inherited it. It is something that your genes can develop through mutations, through exposure to something in the environment. So you may either inherit cancer from a parent or, you know, relative in that manner, or through, say, exposure to radiation or other environmental things like cigarettes, you can develop mutations that then can cause cancer. nonetheless, no matter what the origin is there, when cells become cancerous, they no longer go through interphase and then wait and go through mitosis and then come back through interphase again. They simply go from telophase back into prophase, telophase back into prophase. So what are they skipping? Well, if they finish telophase and go back into prophase, they go through
prophase.
They skip
interphase. Yeah, so they do mitosis and then they skip the growth period. So you're right, they don't allow themselves to regrow. And unfortunately, their cell cycling is off because they're supposed to listen to chemical signals that say, now's the time you grow and now's the time you divide. But they just listen to the signal that says divide, divide, divide constantly. And so that's how you get tumors grow like this one here. I did want to discuss what benign was. If a tumor is benign, where is it?
Within one particular area.
One particular area, exactly. If that tumor becomes malignant, now what happens?
Spread.
And another word for spread?
Metastasize,
right. These are cancer types. Notice most have an oma ending. What does oma tell us?
Tumor.
So carcinomas are epithelial cancers. Adenocarcinomas are gland cancers. I had a student several years ago who had salivary gland cancer. You don't think about salivary glands having cancer, but you know, nonetheless, she had to have that operated on, and that's painful because it kind of weaves its way through all the tissues in your face area. So gland cancers are adenocarcinomas. Sarcomas are flesh cancers, like bone and muscle cancers. What are lymphomas? Lymph nodes, yeah. And what do leukemias affect?
Blood.
Yeah, white blood cells, good.
Okay, so I have a question.
Sure.
These are the basic general types of cancer.
That's right.
So if you have cancers in different areas, like if you have brain cancer of some sort, then it can be any of these types, specific to the area?
That's right. Like, for instance, we'll use breast cancer as an example. It's actually a carcinoma because it affects most commonly the epithelial tissues. These are general, and then you're going to have specific location types. Yep. I wanted to show you this. This was in 2016. The most common cancers in males and females were lung and bronchial cancer, and those are, in fact, are carcinomas. They affect the epithelial tissues of the lungs and the bronchi. Breast and prostate cancer, those are also epithelial, especially breast cancer. Colon and rectal are epithelial, once again, so they're carcinomas. And then we start getting into the digestive organs. Pancreatic cancers are often epithelial cancers because they affect the ductwork of the pancreas. So, in fact, most of these up here are epithelial or carcinoma in nature. So why do you think epithelial tissues cause so many cancers?
They're
exposed. They're exposed to things like bacteria. Other things that cause cancer, like, you know, radiation, sun exposure. And what is it about their growth rate? Constantly. Yeah. If you're a slow grower, you're less likely to see cancers in those areas. The ones that heal and repair quickly are more likely to have cancers. And plus, like you say, epithelial is more exposed to stuff. Let's see. So this is kind of a numbing slide to look at. If you are a female, then 1 in 3 of us have a chance of forming some kind of cancer in our lifetime. That is really a frightening number. For just in general population, we're at a 1 in 8 chance of developing breast cancer. So, you know, that's really a scary, kind of a numbing thought when you think about these cancers. For males, prostate cancer is the most common one there. 1 in 7 chance for males, and males are 50% you know, the time are going to have some type of cancer form during his lifetime. So, again, a very sobering thought. Let's see, and then survival rates are good for those that we can catch quickly and have an easy way to cure and have not metastasized. You'll notice the ones near the top of the list are the ones that we can diagnose, treat, and prevent from spreading. The ones near the bottom of the list are ones that we're not really good at catching and have unfortunately spread to other areas. They say the biggest problem with pancreatic cancer is not the treatment, it's catching it. A lot of times people don't know they have pancreatic or bladder cancer until it's third or fourth stage, and at that point it's spread into surrounding tissues.
My roommate's dad had pancreatic cancer, and he went to the doctor to see if he had stomach pains,
ooh.
And then that same day they told him that he had stage four.
Ooh, awful. To go and think that you're just having stomach issues and then to find that out, that's devastating.
My girlfriend's mom, she was having back leg pain, and they found she, this was just like a couple weeks ago, found out she had pancreatic cancer.
Wow, and that was her symptom, was the leg pain, wow.
She
wow.
Not active, and nothing, just back to back of her leg.
That's sad.
What if she hadn't gone for that, you know?
Right.
Wow.
The problem that she's had it for is
oh, goodness. So gives it time to grow, and yeah. Let's see. You're probably at a good stopping point. Why don't we hit the three cancers for skin on Monday? We're going to cover all of the bone stuff. Do read ahead so that stuff is not hitting you blind on Monday. That's going to be our job. Y'all have a good weekend.